Then we know something about the food problem, the so-called food crisis, and has done something in his church about it. And George has been studying this not only privately, but in his educational experience. And he's pastor of Christ Lutheran Church at Long Beach, one of the pastors, and we're just glad that you're here so we can pay attention to this subject. I can't think of any subject that opens us up to our Christian responsibility more than this one does. George?
Thank you, Al. Let me just take a couple of minutes to share with you how I got interested in it, and really kind of by accident. I was on a sabbatical for 6 months from my parish in Long Beach and trying to decide on a course of study, different courses to take while I was going to School of Theology in Claremont, California. And the classes I had lined up were just the ones I wanted to fill in where I thought I was weak in my ministry. And then the day I arrived for this one class, I discovered that they canceled the class. And I wanted to get my classes on certain days, and I was really disappointed because the subject and the teacher was just what I wanted. And so then I thought, well, what am I going to do? And there was about three other classes I could take. And the one that interested me least was titled World Hunger and Christian Institutional Response. I was there to study for things that would really help me in the ministry, to help me proclaim the gospel more clearly, more forcefully, more meaningfully to my congregation. I thought, hunger, fine, that'll last for a few months, but I want something that's going to last me the rest of my ministry. So I tried a couple other courses, and they weren't interesting. So I sat in just a couple of times on this World Hunger class because it happened to be offered the time when I was available. And, well, the net result was it really changed my life. I got hooked into that thing, and it was as though I came into the presence of Christ in that class, in a way that I'd never experienced before in all my academic pursuits. I'd gone to all kinds of theological classes, Bible study classes, and gone to school about 21 years, but I'd never met Christ the way I did in this class on world hunger. And it changed my life. So I continued my interest and my reading about it, and have tried to work with it as a family, with my children, my wife, with the congregation, with the community, with the world. And it's a lifelong process, I think, now. And I don't claim to know an awful lot, but I'm starting to get a little realization of what the problem is, some of the causes, and some of the possible solutions. One thing that kept me going in the class was my teacher's optimistic outlook about the possibilities for the world. And the hope, he feels, lies with the church, with Christians, who not only believe in Jesus, but believe in the application of the gospel for the world. And his optimism, his hopeful outlook, kept me going in that class. And I'm very interested in finding response from people like you and others who are either in touch with it or are some just beginning to get exposed to it, to find out some of the questions you have and some of the feelings, some of the experiences, and some of the things that you're doing in your corner of the world. In face of this worldwide problem. Just to get at the problem a little bit, I assume all of you know, maybe I shouldn't assume, that hunger is a world crisis today. And it relates closely with poverty. Poverty and hunger go hand in hand. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time tonight in getting at figures and statistics and going back and going over the countries of the world where people are starving to death. I think most of us are aware of that. And yet we need to be reminded, you know, just to say that since you were here last night, or at Vespers last night, 10,000 people have died because of hunger or related diseases related to hunger. Now that can go in one ear and out the other, and sure, 10,000 people die every day. So what? Most of us here have not suffered from hunger. We have not been to that place where we would do anything, including kill, to get something in our stomachs. So it's hard for us to both experience physically what it means to be hungry, and it's hard for us to visualize what it means that the world is facing a crisis of food. So for most of us, it's difficult to get into. It takes a while. It takes a few exposures and some education, some knowledge to really kind of get with it. So we need to help each other in that area. Maybe to get at it a little bit, it might help you to visualize a table tonight, a meal table, which is worldwide, symbolic of the world. There are 10 people at the table, all of them children of God, created by God in His image. All of them have some basic needs in order to survive physically. 10 people, 3 people at the table are eating very well. They're up at the one end up here, if you can visualize a table. They're eating at least 3 meals a day, and quite a variety of food. And they're eating more calories, more protein than their body really needs or can endure. And they have no fear of, or no problem of ever seeing a need for food. It's just never an issue for them. That represents the rich countries of the world. There are 2 other people on the left-hand side of the table who are also eating regularly, but not very much. They only have enough to survive, and it's the same kind of food almost every meal. But they do have enough to survive and to maintain a nutritious lifestyle. There are 5 others at the same table, that is a part of the same world that we belong to, and 3 of those people, of the other 5, are suffering severe malnutrition or some form of deficiency in their body because they don't have enough food. Many of their children are mentally retarded. Many of them become blind because they don't have enough nutrition during their early years, and they are suffering because of the lack of food. At the same table, there are 2 people who are dying, and in fact, they are so weak they don't have enough energy to do anything. And before we are finished eating, they will die because of the lack of food. But it will not be hunger they die from. They will die from pneumonia. They will die from some related disease that stems back to the fact they didn't have enough food. And many of these people who are either suffering or dying of hunger, they are becoming more aware of those of us who have plenty of food. And they are at the same table, that is, they are part of the same world. One of the difficult things is that, not difficult, embarrassing things, is that the 3 people who are eating very well at this table, for the most part, are Christians. That is, they come from Christian nations that have a Christian orientation, Christian background, with a large percentage of the people in those countries who are Christians, who are eating very well. And they are saying to the rest of the world, God loves you, and we love you. And we will send missionaries to your country, if we can, because we are interested in the fact that you go to heaven and that you hear about God's love for you. And so they are sitting at their end of the table, eating their scraps and suffering and dying, and they are understanding that up there where those people eat well, that's where the Christians are. And they're wondering what effect that's going to have upon their survival. Well, just so we visualize the world and how we belong to a global village, we belong to each other in the world. And this word interdependence and interawareness of each other's situation is very important, I think, for Christians today. When I talk, I may sound at times like I want to put a guilt trip on you. And I don't want to do that because I know that guilt is a very inadequate and poor motivator for anybody to do something. But many times awareness of a situation is going to bring about some kind of bad feelings or guilt feelings, and we can either avoid that by avoiding the facts, or we can allow that to move us into asking the question, what can I do? And how can I change my lifestyle to make a difference? But whenever you get into the hunger issue, the food issue of the world, there's going to be some guilt feelings on the part of those of us who sit at that one end of the table and eat very well. Not eating the food that is placed before our table is not necessarily going to, you know, solve the problem either. So don't get the feeling that if you go to the other end of the table and just not eat, that that's the answer to the situation. Or don't, or also the problem of not enjoying the food you have. You know, we can sit at our tables and eat this luscious food, delicious food, and say, and feel guilty about that, you know. But still eat it, and that isn't going to solve the problem by feeling guilty about the food we eat. But guilt is going to come into the picture. Let me quickly share with you 10 causes of hunger. Freudenberger has shared with us, he's the man I took this class from at Claremont, and there are others, to be sure, and these are very complex, interrelated, but I think Christians ought to become aware of the complexity of the causes of hunger in the world. Otherwise, we begin to live on myths, and there are all kinds of myths and half-truths and easy, simplistic answers to the situation. So we've got to be aware of the complexity and the interrelatedness of the causes of hunger. One of them is neocolonialism. And I'll just briefly touch on them because we won't have time to go into them tonight. Neocolonialism is that the result of the colonial age, where many of the third world countries were under the political influence or power of countries like England, America, Spain, France, and so on. And once we left these countries and they fought or asked for their independence, we left with these countries in Africa and Asia, some of the islands, a kind of structure that made it very difficult for them to support themselves with food enough for their people to eat. We left the kind of people in power that were military-minded, and the people in power were primarily concerned about having a strong military force to ward off other countries, and so they couldn't concentrate on developing food for their country because they were busy buying guns and airplanes and tanks and so on. And many times we left them so dependent upon using or selling their commodity to us or to the first world that they couldn't concentrate on developing crops that would feed their people. For example, we made them dependent upon growing tea or growing coffee or growing rubber because that was the only way they could get any money. That's what we came down there for in the first place, was to get these products. And when we left there, we made them very dependent upon raising these crops for their economic stability. And you don't feed a country by growing tea, or you don't feed your people by growing rubber. But yet in the neocolonialism, we have left them very dependent upon those crops. That's one of the causes of these many countries that are having problems today, neocolonialism. And there's a lot more to that also. But another one is resource abuse. If you take three of the key resources that God has given us, land, water, and air, and take a look at what we have done with those three resources in the world, you can see how it has caused much poverty and hunger in the world, that we have not been very good stewards of the resources God has given us. The water, you can look at the pollution of the water, overfishing on the part of the rich nations, and what that has done in terms of the abuse of water. The air, what we have done, many people now feel that the pollution of the air is causing some change in climate and weather patterns in other parts of the world, so that the smog and the stuff that rises up from our big cities is not just affecting us in our big cities, but it's affecting global climate patterns. And so our misuse of the air, our abuse of the air is causing problems in raising crops in certain parts of the world. Take land, the fact that we have not taken good care of our land. Take a look at Africa, how much more and more Africa is becoming a desert because of the misuse of the land there. Or take parts of India and Nepal and how the monsoon rains. Talk to Daniel here, who's here from India, and if they aren't careful, when the rains come, it washes away much of the fertile land, or our multinational corporations have gone in and need more land to raise things, so they've cut down the trees and the brush so they could have more tillable land. And if that happens, the rains come and they wash all that soil down, and that brush and those trees were necessary to keep the land there. Just a sample of the resource abuse. 6% of the population, those of us in America, are using about 40% of the world's resources today. Another example of a kind of resource abuse or inequity in the use of resources in the world. I can't spend much time on these. Another one is the dearth of agricultural leadership. And this, you know, is a very complex thing. There are not very many people who are going into the leadership and research of what could be done in terms of agriculture. There is a missionary in my class from the Philippine Islands, not a missionary, but a native of the Philippine Islands, and he was encouraging his son to go into agriculture for the Philippine Islands. And he started in that direction, but then he discovered that there's no scholarship money available for that, and if you want to get ahead, you've got to become a teacher or a lawyer or a doctor. And so the kind of leadership that we you know, are getting in the world is not in agriculture, but that's where the real need is. And we have a dearth of leadership as far as our church is concerned. We send over doctors, we send over teachers, we send over nurses to our mission fields, but how many people do we send over that are experts in agriculture? Not very many. How many of your children would think of going into agriculture today as a profession? One of the greatest needs of helping the world survive is agriculture. We have a dearth of leadership and we don't give it a high priority. You know, you're going into farming? What's wrong with you? One of the greatest needs today. How can we develop leadership in terms of agriculture for the world? The Myth of Aid, it's an interesting book if you want to read it. We think that our country is doing a great thing and giving away money to help develop these poor countries, and some things we're doing, it, you know, are commendable, but much of our aid that we give away as a country goes to military assistance, and it isn't going to help develop those countries in the long range kind of way. And much of our aid really comes back as a profit to us. This is a hard thing for us to stomach. Jim Berquist, who's at Cap Seminary now, came to our district convention and he really blew our minds. Half of us didn't hear what he was saying, but he has studied this thing in India and in England, and he said it can be documented that for every dollar of aid that we give to South America, we make $4. We profit $4 for every dollar we give. And so we cry, all this foreign aid we're giving away. Yeah, we're not giving it away. For every dollar we give to Latin America, we make $4 back again. The myth of aid. And so much of it is tied into military grants. That whole PL 480, the one law that was passed some years ago, which was to help foreign countries who are developing, is being kind of revamped now and reformed under McGovern and Hatfield, because it has so been so tied into military assistance rather than helping economic and agricultural assistance. Multinational corporations, that's a big field to get into. So many of the big corporations of our country and Europe also and Australia are going into these countries and they're making money, but they're not always keeping in mind what's going to help develop that country, but rather what brings profit back to America. Man, we're part of that. You'd be surprised how many salaries right in this room that we earn are dependent upon multinational corporations that are making their money on foreign investments and foreign soil and foreign resources. If we really begin to explore that, it's your pocketbook and my pocketbook that's going to suffer if we begin to make some changes in that. The control and the effect of multinational corporations throughout the world is really devastating, I think. Arms race, that was one thing I was assigned to do a paper on, and I was completely ignorant of what's happening in the world regarding the arms race and what effect that has on world hunger. Art Simon, if you ever get a chance to read this book, by the way, I really recommend it. It's in the bookstore here. You can buy it for a buck and a half. Bread for the World by Art Simon, a Lutheran pastor, really gets at the problem in a very readable, short book. He talks about how we have the overkill capacity today, and how much that is costing us to have the capacity to kill all the major population of the world about 30 times. We aren't going to kill everybody once, we're going to kill them about 30 times with our arms race. And every man, woman, and child in America in 1976 is giving $450 for military costs, $35 for education, $18 for housing, $6 for economic assistance to hungry nations. So you and I, every one of us, are giving this year $450 to help build up our military defense and $6 for economic assistance. Now, what do you do about that? When the bill comes up before Congress for increased national defense spending, people who cry out for national security, we've got to get stronger than the Russians, we've got to get stronger than this nation, Congress seems to pass the bill, increased budget, and they don't talk about inflation or deficit spending then, but other programs, and they cry out. There's a sacred cow in our country, and I call it national defense. We're willing to spend anything for national defense, but spend money to help people who are oppressed in the world or are going to have a problem eating, that's a different story. Now, I know that that's not, it's an oversimplification, because if we are not strong, in a sense, we might be vulnerable to annihilation also. But I think that there is a sense in which we've got to be a little more responsible in the priority that we give to building guns and bombs and ships as over against helping people. The B-1 bomber now is coming up before Congress. Are we going to spend billions of dollars on that? And it seems what happens, as I study the issue, we need the B-1 bomber because the Russians have an airplane that's almost as good as ours. So we spend over $100 billion for our national defense this year. And when the Russians see that we have the B-1 bomber, they're spending $100 billion. They're going to spend more because they aren't going to let us have the best airplane. You can be sure of that. So they're going to build a better one. As soon as they build a better one, we're going to have to build a better one. And it goes back and forth. And where this is going to end up is kind of scary. This whole military defense thing and the arms race. What are we doing? We're building up the military capacity of Israel. Then we build it up for the Arab nations. And then the other one needs to have more. And so we are making all kinds of money by selling arms to all these countries and getting them to have all kinds of military defense, but helping them to develop their economics and their ability to feed themselves. There's no time for that, no money for that, because we make our money on arms sale. Reading the Time magazine last year, the amount of money that we make on arms sale, and all of us are making money on it. I don't care what your job is. We're making money on that. That's what's making us more prosperous in our country. It's a scary thing. Trade and tariff. Just a simple example of what's happening there. The poor nations are always suffering on the trade laws that happens in our world. It's as though you and I were playing in a ball game and I get to call the rules. So your team, when you score, you get 1 point. When my team scores, we get 5 points, okay? We get 5 outs, you get 2 outs, okay? You say, that isn't fair. You're calling the shots. That's exactly what's happening in the world regarding trade between nations. The rich countries are calling the shots as to the rules of the game in trade and who benefits, you know, and who gets the lower end of the spectrum. It's the poor countries. It used to be, you know, we would pull in some rubber or tea or coffee or peanuts from another country, and we'd give them, say, $100 a bushel. That's a bad example, but say $100 a bushel. We'd give them, and then we'd turn around and sell them a tractor for $100. You know, but now, it's turned around where we only give them $50 for that same bushel of product, and we turn around and charge them $500 for that tractor. And they have nothing to say about it, because we call the shots, the rich countries. UNCTAD now, an international organization trying to get a little bit more fairness in the trade and tariff policies of the world that will help these fourth world nations develop themselves. And the United States has a chance to play a key role there. Whether or not they will, I think, is a big question mark. Population explosion. I suppose the number one cause of world hunger that most people latch onto first is, hey, you know, stop this population explosion and you'll solve the problem. Too many mouths to feed, and that's the problem. And it is a problem. 4 billion today to feed in, 24 years we'll have 8 billion. Another 35 years, maybe 15 billion mouths, if it keeps going the way it is. And how are we going to feed all those people? Just stop having babies and we'll solve the problem of hunger. It isn't quite that simple, although the population explosion is a major problem. But we've got to understand the population thing. why some of these countries, you know, have many children. And we in America can sit here and probably give some easy answers to that, but it isn't quite that easy for many people in the world. Children. So the wheat covenant is for those Christians who want to enter into a fivefold commitment, that they want to do something about it. And here are the five commitments. I'll briefly share them with you. One is to commit yourself to intensive study. Read the newspaper. Read some of the books. They've got some in the bookstore over here, by Bread Alone, by Lester Brown, and this Bread for the World. They've got Small is Beautiful by Shoemaker, and a few others that are really good. And they're not, don't take you long to read. So become, study, become informed. Number two, get directly involved. I guess they're numbered differently up here. Support an advocacy effort. That is, back up your congressmen and congresswomen on issues on the national scale that are affecting world hunger and food issues. Art Simon makes the point in here that one decision in Congress will do more either to help or wipe out every benevolent dollar that is collected by all churches in America. Get that. All the benevolent dollars that all of our churches can gather together for world hunger in America can be either wiped out or multiplied by one decision in Congress, as far as the effect that it has on hunger in the world. Now, he says, by no means stop giving your dollars. That's important. But if we do that without becoming an advocate, without encouraging our national leaders, we're gonna lose the battle. There's some very key issues that are being, you know, decided upon by our representatives in Congress. And Bread for the World is one organization you can join for $10 a year, and they'll send you a monthly newsletter about every issue in Congress. This is Art Simon's organization, headed up by a Lutheran pastor. Well, all he does is keep informed of what's coming before Congress and what effects does it have on food issues in the world. And David Price, our president of the ALC, encouraged every pastor to become a member of this, and he encouraged every pastor to encourage every member of the churches to become a member of Bread for the World, just to get informed of the issues. So advocacy is another thing you commit yourself to. Last Thanksgiving, many of you wrote, I think, on this right to food issue, that there were a campaign for letters around Thanksgiving time. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, become directly involved in local hunger, domestic hunger. We can't just talk about it over there, because it's right in our back door. It's not either or, it's both and. But the local hunger is invisible hunger. We don't see it. How many of you know people in your neighborhood, a radius of 25 miles, who are really suffering from hunger? We don't know about it, but it's there if we get into it. And what are the causes of it? We have a panic pantry in our church, and every communion Sunday we come to the Lord's table to receive the bread of life. We bring bread or canned food to share with the needy, and that's good. But unless we do more than just share it, we've got to find out why, what's happening in our local community. What are the causes of that? So directly involved in local. Fourthly, giving of your money, whatever it is. Lutheran World Relief is one of the best organizations to give it to. I was, you know, Freudberger, my teacher, he was criticizing every national, international organization that was in the hunger problem in the world. And he's saying how they are not looking ahead, they're not developing, they're just giving Band-Aid help. And I thought, man, here's a Methodist who knows the whole world. I didn't even dare ask him about Lutheran World Relief. But one day after class, kind of sheepishly, I went up to him and I said, hey, Dean, how's Lutheran World Relief doing? He says, George, they're one of the best in the world as far as what they're doing for world hunger. They are looking ahead. They're investing their money very wisely. If you give your money to Lutheran World Relief, you're giving it to one of the very best in the world. I thought for sure he was going to treat us like he had everybody else. But, and he was a Methodist, so he had no axe to grind about the Lutherans. Fifthly, change your lifestyle. And here's, I suppose, where it affects most of us. You commit yourself that I'm going to change my lifestyle. Maybe not radically, but a little bit at a time, as the Spirit of God leads me, and as we can do it corporately together and individually, as families and as a church. And there's several suggestions that they will send you as to how you can change your lifestyle. And but if you only change your lifestyle without some of these others, you know, it's not going to be very effective. It can't be just doing one thing. All five of these commitments or covenants are important if we're going to make a dent in this thing. You could add several others, including prayer and repentance. And the other stuff that the church is doing too. Well, anyway, in our church we have a number of people who have committed themselves to WEED. We have a task force that goes, meets regularly. And one other thing I would suggest, if you really are serious about doing something in the area of responsible action, get a support group to help you. If you do it alone, it becomes very lonely and very difficult to keep it up. Find others who are concerned, who are committed in some ways to the same thing, and get together and support each other. You need a support group to keep going in the area of responsible action concerning food and hunger in the world. Excuse me for taking so long, but when I get going on this, it's hard for me to stop. I'd be happy to listen and respond to any questions you may have.
Were you encouraged by the response of the gifts of that book to the members of your church? Because I don't know what your expectation was, but
yeah.
did you get a fairly decent-sized group, or enough, at least enough to make a core group really swing it? Just with that Christmas?
Yeah. I suppose I didn't dare take a survey to find out how many had read it, but in a number of sermons, I'd say maybe five sermons since that time, I've held this book up and said, now as we learned, or as you read in this book, or...
Maybe it would be a good idea to kind of have a small group around it, you know. We have a lot of those in the church, and it's really neat.
Yeah, right, I think we do have, we have not had one just concerned with this book. We got one member who left our church because we handed this book out.
He didn't like it?
He
didn't like it,
no. Yeah.
I was a delegate to the United States Food Conference that Kent held at Kansas City last August, and we spent 3 days discussing what you've been talking about, what we might do to alleviate world hunger, and you have 16 categories, and I haven't got the time to go into those now. But you haven't answered the question tonight. You've worked on the spiritual end of it and changing people. And we've got to change the people of the nations and teach them. You worked on it a little bit, but we're going to have to teach them how to help themselves. And I spent, Faye and I spent 2 months in Africa teaching Africans in a laboratory to use tools and working with the scientists in the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture. I worked with Castro in the Philippines on rice. I worked with Maynor in South America to some extent, South American version, and we have a lot of these organizations working to help for potatoes and for the, you probably know the man who worked on the dwarf wheats and the...
Herman Borlaug.
Borlaug, who was a man from Iowa, and they had a World Food Conference in Iowa just last month. And did you follow that closely? They just aren't making that kind of progress. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with the nations making a profit. A nation that isn't making a profit is in a terrible condition. We've got our economies based on profit. We must have it, or else we're going to change your economy. And it is a difficult problem. I'm ready to admit that it's a difficult problem. Kwashiorkor, which kills so many people, many children, they have to breed 10 children to, in some places, to get 3 or 4 raised. This is tremendously high infant deaths. Then we go in and solve their medical problems so some of the adults can die. This population problem will not solve itself, but it will solve itself pretty largely if we don't let nature take its course we shouldn't. This is not the Christian thing to do. But it's a tremendous problem, and I'm going to be on a panel next month at Friends University discussing what you're talking about, and that's the reason I listened and took notes from you. But you haven't answered the question. You have tried, and you've said some things we can do. I don't know what to do, but we are spending way, way too much for overkill. This thing, you can't kill anybody 30 times. Just kill them once. Takes care. It's terrible. And this B-1 bomber was so obsolete before they started talking about it. We can shoot the darn things down as fast as we want to with the modern methods of tracers. We merely set the thing out here, and when it goes by, we'll send a machine after it, and we'll chase it down. And in the last war in Israel, they shot down every plane that they had one of these tracers to hack. We can shoot those billion-dollar bombers down so fast that they're obsolete. And the same thing is true for airplane carriers. We're going to blast them out of the ocean.
Floyd, I expected you to go more into detail about research, since that's kind of your area, and the need for specialized research that's geared to the country, because there are all kinds of problems in developing the kinds of brains that
I
are agree. Relevant.
I should do that, but I get wound up too. this problem in the dwarfed wheats and the kinds of wheats that we developed and Borlaug developed, and we take them over to Africa, and unless you have the fertilizers and the things that it takes to go with it, the native strains very often do better than the high-powered ones we bring in. This is... and you simply don't get the job done that way. You've got to go and train them how to do it. And you can do more with your Peace Corps people, the people who will go in and help go in and do these things than you can ever do by sending food. And food is a band. Sending food to a hungry man is a band-aid. And I talked to a man who said that, give my family some food and then keep your prayers and I'll do my own praying. The prayers, there isn't any question of what we should pray about. It will change what we do, probably. But it very likely won't do too much for the people that don't know you're even praying. Well, okay. I've said too much already. Somebody else take the care of the state of what?
Well, the one thing I did think I picked up from you was the need for research and development.
Oh yes, the tremendous need for research and development of...
But that we not do it, but it be done in terms of the needs, because I understand that some of our foods just don't provide the kind of nourishment. You get all kinds of...
high lysine corn and high lysine wheat, which will cure quash or corn without animals.
And you change the diets and then all kinds of...
All kinds
diseases
of
occur.
Diseases disappear. Yes, indeed. They do that. And so many of them die, they just die because they, they go blind because they don't get enough vitamin A. This is a cure for, not a cure, but a preventer. We need more health in the world, prevention of disease and... And it's pretty hard to prove what you're doing when you you aren't curing something, you just keep it in thing from developing.
Where does the money come from for the research? And is that part of the advocacy program? The money for the research.
The money from the research.
For the research.
For the research could come from a lack of building more A-bombs and things like this. Our military budget is ridiculous. Way, way, miles too high.
George, I guess, for me in that place, I see a close connection between what this gentleman is saying, what you are offering to us here
yes.
in the first hour. That the research that he does over there is research that I'm happy and thankful to know is getting done that I can't go over and do if I don't have the schooling education and the ability you do to do that. But if someone can share with me like George has done now, it may be because of efforts of my getting on the back of my congressman or getting the people in my congregation to be involved in the WEAK program, that there's money available for not only you, but maybe another 10,000 people to go do that same thing. I mean, it's that long-range thing. You know, they're also interrelated. Until this consciousness is there, until then, I'm not really that much aware of the need for people to be developing the kind of research in the grains and the local health that you've been, that this guy's been involved in.
You simply must have the research work, or you aren't going to get it done. You must understand the biological and the physiological conditions and the chemistry of the thing you're working with. And this, there has been a breakthrough in the plant breeding. We go overboard. What you read in the newspapers is far from the truth in many cases. Where you can cross a mouse with an elephant. I don't know what you get, but... these crossing of diseases and the possibilities of letting a disease escape. This cloning and stuff of this nature. So, the possibilities are before us and will be in the next 10 years. We will have plants that you and I have never seen before. God made them. He made the wheat and he made the oats and he made the rye and he made the corn and he made all of these things and he made them more or less accidentally. And God lets man, in the form of scientists, discover how to do things. People say the terrible demons made the A-bombs when they found out how to do this. God revealed atomic power to us at a time in history, and we are to use it for His glory. And when we learn to use it properly, instead of blowing ourselves off the face of the earth with it, we will have no atomic waste, but we will have atomic power used for what God created it for.
Now that's another issue. That's my issues.
Okay, get me back in line.
Now one of the problems seems to be that you have to have economic development in these nations in order to provide for their own for fertilizer, for transportation, or all kinds of developments. And if they don't have that economic development that goes along with the development of agriculture, that's a total economic development, as I understand.
That gets into that trade laws that allow the countries to survive. And some of them can hardly survive when the crops that they are growing, they're getting no money for. So their whole economic base is affected by the trade laws.
And the increase in energy costs has really affected their capacity to produce in terms of buying the energy that they need for some of their equipment.
See what happened to India now and their need for fertilizer, like the dwarf wheat that Norman Borlaug developed was really dependent upon fertilizer. And then when the Arab countries put that price of oil up, the price of fertilizer went sky high and they just can't afford to grow those crops.
You're right. Absolutely right.
Questions
over here.
Okay.
Afterward.
No, I was just
going to
point.
Oh,
yeah, that's
great.
Well,
all right. All right, I'll go ahead. You have listed a number of positives. First of all, I want to say that I certainly don't want to minimize the the hunger that there is, nor our obligation to do all we can to alleviate this hunger. But I'd just like to pose a question as to causes. Seven causes that you have listed are somehow connected with industrialized nations and their activities. You just referred to one, the trade laws. Now, the question I have is, if, let's say, we assume there hadn't ever been any industrialized nations, can we therefore conclude that there would only be 30% of the hunger in the world that there is today? Could you comment on that?
Well, I'm not sure what you're getting at.
Well, you have 10 reasons for hunger in the world.
The problem,
7 of those are connected with industrialized nations and the abuses that they have perpetrated upon the world. Now, let's say we remove those. Let's say they never existed. Those countries never existed. Those industrialized nations. Now, the other 5 people at the table that you were talking about, they do exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if these industrialized nations had never existed, would they be only 1/3 as bad off as they are now?
I don't know. I know that the problem is not industrialized nations, but the problem is inequities and injustice. Now, whether it be industrialized nations or others, I think that it's a human problem that we're dealing with. And if the industrial nations would have been Africa and India, you know, rather than America, and they could have been, you know, you and I may be in the third world today.
Let's turn the question around. Why is it that the nations that are starving are the nations to which we are most closely tied, have been mostly closely tied, and China, to which we are not tied at all, is taking care of all of its food problems and all of its health problems and all of its housing problems? I mean, I just turn around on you and say, why is it those nations where somehow our economy and our life is still most closely related in some way or other, and the people who were associated with our colonial powers and are still in power there, here and there at least for the most part, are part of the power structure, are the nations which are having problems? No, I don't have an answer, but I think it's a very, very frightening kind of thing to see that some people are who abandon us and our way of doing things are able to solve at least that problem. They may not like the way they solve them, but they don't have the hunger problem.
One copy of Science magazine, and there are some 14-15 authors in it, and Sprague went to China and wrote on that very subject that you're talking about, and I read it because Sprague used to be at Iowa and was a corn breeder, and he came back and wrote on the very subject you're talking about, and I didn't bring the magazine with me, and so I can't quote him correctly, but it does, they force their professors to go out in the field and work with the people, train them. They don't put them off in a university and let them teach. They go out and show. This is one of the things that they do. If we had our ag teachers and our salesmen out actually doing some of the work instead of sitting in the desk and theorizing, maybe we might get somewhere. I'm not sure.
Is there?
There's a gal up there that had a question, I think, some time ago.
I was just considering the idea of food as a weapon.
Yeah. Real butts.
Using economic aid, food aid particularly, as a way of manipulating the politics of the nation. I was fortunate enough to listen to a man who's president of the World Peace Congregation seminar in India, and he knew Ayente very well. And he asked Ayente, before he was assassinated, why he wasn't getting CIA out of his country. And he said, we are totally dependent on them for food and economic aid. And if I remove the CIA out, there goes our food and economic aid. And it was a really pointed comment. Obviously, he knew what was going on, that he was being subverted, and yet he could not. People were starved.
That whole book, Myth of Aid, would reinforce what you're saying, that most of our aid has been politically motivated. And some people would really defend that, you know. We have a right to use our aid to to help our friends and to destroy our enemies.
Another good resource area for people if they're interested in finding out what's being put before Congress nationally as well as in California is the Berkeley Co-op News, to which you can subscribe. Mm. And it's very politically aware in terms of the World Hunger.
Yeah, I'm sort of interested in the response to famine. And maybe you know some statistics of, say, northern latitude people when they experienced famine, whether there was a strong increase in the birth rate per thousand, as there is in Africa, Bangladesh, and so on, compared to, say, the Irish famine or the 30s depression that the United States went through, whether we had a decrease in our birth rate or an increase such as they experienced.
I don't have any statistics at my fingertips on that. Are you aware of any?
But that seems to be the whole problem. And some people are even saying we have to raise the level of their economy to a point that would even approximate ours in order for them to take on the responsibility of reducing their birth rate.
Yeah, there is a thesis that middle class, as you approach middle class, you cut down the number of children here.
Yeah.
So that it would be an economic revolution that would really be the most important factor in controlling the world's population. Well, maybe we should call us to a close.
One final comment. I really encourage you to read your Bibles and see how much interest there is in the Bible for poor people. I had never really opened my eyes to that. And what the Lord saw fit to establish in the Old Testament for poor people. Every 3 years, a tithe of everything the people got was given to poor people. Every 7 years, there was the year of the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee. And there was a law that you could not harvest all of your crop. You had to leave some for poor people. The Lord provided for poverty and for poor people in the Old Testament. There was a concern. And in the New Testament, see how many parables Jesus used, talks about the poor people. And the economic system that would have developed if we would follow some of Jesus' parables might approximate more of a kind of socialism than you and I are ready to admit, I think. But there is a deep concern on the part of the biblical writers, and I believe inspired by the Holy Spirit, for a more equal distribution of the basic necessities of life.
Can I make a comment? I hear a lot of connotation, I think, from you gentlemen about our political system and our economic system, and particularly multinational corporations, but they're nothing more than an extension of human beings. You say, don't feel guilty yourselves, but what our economic system does, what our political system does, and what our corporations do is nothing more than an extension of our own selfishness. Mm-hmm. When you try to say that it's not, it's wrong, I think.
I didn't mean to say that it was not. Yeah, it's a good word. We're all part of the problem, and we're all part of the solution.
If we think that we can just blame the corporations, and that takes our guilt away from us, that's wrong.
No, I said we're all getting richer because of that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one fact really just throws me. They flare enough gas in Saudi Arabia every day to provide for the fertilizer that the agricultural experts predict will be necessary for the world in 2000. That is, they just flare it. They burn it. And this is our responsible world, and we let it happen. It just makes you feel, I don't know how you get personally responsible for doing anything about that.
That's what's needed, though, isn't it?
But somehow it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong to use the resources of the world that way.
And every one of us do it that way.
And we want that oil. And they want to get the money from it.
The gas that they're flaring is the same kind of gas that we use in this country to make ammonia for our fertilizer.
That's right.
33,000 cubic feet will make approximately 1 ton of ammonia, which is a lot of gas. And they flare it, they just burn it off because they have an oil well and you can't mix oil and gas. They just don't go. you got to get rid of one or the other.
Well, they could get the, they could take the gas off and manufacture if they wanted to.
They could if they wanted to. That's true.
You're going to say something, Mary?
I was just going to say that I think that the primary thing that we all need is to quit procrastinating and putting it off till tomorrow. I mean, I think this is a problem. You know, well, I'll get around to writing my congressman. I'll get around to reading it. I'll get around to doing it. At, you know, maybe another day. And I think you have to sense what has been very much apparent here, that this is an immediate problem.
It's an immediate problem, but there's not an immediate solution.
No, but you see, you can't, I mean, if, don't say that, because if you keep on saying there's no immediate solution, we'll all say, well, okay, I'll wait around then. No,
we must work at it daily.
First step is very important.
The first step is the
I am really personally convinced that every congregation, if it's responsible at all, would have a food task force. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any great hopes that that's going to change the world overnight. But without people in every congregation who begin to know as much as you do, George, you must have other lay people who are beginning to share your interest and your feeling.